For this month of Still Loading, it's Mario Month.
Woohoo!
Hey guys, it's Josh, and welcome back to this new episode of Still Loading. For this entire month, as you probably heard on the little intro segment, snippet, whatever it may be, it is Mario Month. So, for this entire month, I'm covering the first three Super Mario Brothers games. Not the original Mario's, not Donkey Kong, and I already did the original Mario Bros. In general, which was not much to really talk about, but we're covering... I'm covering the first three Super Mario Brothers, and to help me here is my friend Casey, back from, well, not the dead, but from the podcasting dead.
I love being here, and especially talking about Super Mario.
Excellent. So, yes, we're talking about the original Super Mario Brothers, the classic, the game that started it all, the game that really cemented video games as a solid industry in the U.S. So, I guess before we really go into it, and to really talk about the game, I do want to talk about the history, but first, let's talk about your personal experience with Mario, Casey. We might have said this before, but for those who haven't listened to the previous episodes, and I honestly don't remember if we included this in the previous episodes, because we don't script any of this shit. It's all off the cuff, all off the fly and junk. So, what's your personal history with Mario? Where did you come to fall in love with our Lord and Savior, Mario?
So, believe it or not, it was actually my grandfather introduced me to Mario.
Really?
Yeah. So, he bought a Super Nintendo at a Kmart nearby, and then he took it home, and it was actually bundled with Super Mario World, and I was about two at the time when he got it, so this is like around 92, 93. So, I was just over his house one day, you know, as a little kid, toddler, and then he was just showing me it, and immediately, I fell in love with it. You know, when I was playing it at the time, I obviously didn't know what I was doing, but I was enjoying myself so much that I continued to play it. And, you know, as much as I love the games today, it's more so of like a nostalgic feeling with these types of games. And whenever I play it, I think of, you know, the time that I've spent, you know, with my papa playing these games.
Yeah, at your grandfather's house. Yeah. And honestly, that's a lot of the reason I do this podcast, because part of this for me is nostalgia-based. A lot of it, in fact, is nostalgia-based. I love looking at these games and kind of going back to that simpler time. But the other half for me is I have, I guess, misplaced nostalgia. Like, I get nostalgic looking at Castlevania. I didn't grow up with the NES. Like, Mario is at least, like, he's so, what's the word I'm looking for? He's so ubiquitous that he's, you know, like, you don't have to, even if you never played the original Mario games growing up, by knowing everything about him, because he's so all over the place, you feel like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mario, it's a little different, but with NES games in general, I get super nostalgic. And I know this podcast isn't meant to be just retro games, but for the last year and a half, it's pretty much been just that with this 40 for 40 series.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, at least with Mario, I remember playing Mario 1 and 3 specifically, maybe bits of 2, over at a church friend's house, and playing it on their Nintendo, which I did not know that's what it was at the time, and I was just in love with it, but I didn't really know anything about it or know what I was doing, I just remember playing it, and I remember my neighbor having a Sega Genesis, and wondering why Mario wasn't on the Sega Genesis. Funny to think of that now with the whole console war thing and all, but I was like, why don't you have Mario, man? It was just dumb, but no. So let's dive into this, right? So we covered a little bit about, you know, our history with it, just kind of touched on it. Let's talk about the history of Mario. Now, I'm not going to go into crazy lengths of depth, but Casey and I are both pretty, I wouldn't say we call us video game historians, but we love video game history in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mario is interesting because a lot of people know that Mario started on Donkey Kong, and that's true. But what a lot of people don't know is how Donkey Kong even started. So I'm going to give a small little history on the creation of Donkey Kong, which of course led to the creation of Mario. So Donkey Kong, the arcade cabinet, was actually not originally... It's interesting how it came about. So in the early 80s, Nintendo was trying to break into the U.S. video game market. It didn't really have any games that had a strong foothold like Pong did, which granted that Atari was an American company, but you know, later on you had Space Invaders and Galaxian, and like a lot of games that Namco would end up making. Pac-Man was a Namco title, stuff like that. And so they were trying to find a killer app, you know, well, not really app back then, a killer cabinet to break into the U.S. game market. And so they made this game called Radar Scope, which was a type of Galaxian ripoff, essentially. Did you ever play it, Casey?
I've only seen videos. I read it in the that one book I was telling you about, but that's, you know, off topic.
Well, this is actually where we got the information from. Yeah. The Super Mario book. It's Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America by Jeff Ryan. For those who love Nintendo history, give this book a read. It's super interesting.
It's a must.
Definitely. And it's an easy read, too. Like, he doesn't go over the top with super flowery language or, like, unnecessarily complicated adjectives. So it's really nice. But in any case, Radar Scope was introduced to the U.S. market. I don't remember the year off the top of my head. I want to say like 81 or 82. I don't remember the exact year, but it wasn't doing well. It wasn't doing well. It was the early 80s, and it was not selling well in arcades, and they needed some way to sell these. And so Nintendo didn't want to go home empty-handed. I mean, they had just got into America practically. They needed another game, and the problem is that they had all these thousands of, or at least hundreds, I don't know the exact number, but a ton of Radar Scope cabinets, and no one was buying them. They sent word back to Nintendo of Japan, and they basically were trying to brainstorm a way to get use out of these because no one wanted this game. So there are these things that you could do back in the day for arcade cabinets called conversion kits. And conversion kits, essentially, think of it like primitive DLC, where you literally are just taking physical new hardware, slapping that shit onto the motherboard of the game, and it alters how the game plays. It's literal DLC. It's not DLC, not literal, I guess. It's primitive DLC. You know, no downloading, just, you know, shipping and slapping that new motherboard, whatever the fuck, onto the existing cabinet's hardware. And so they were trying to design a game within the limitations of Radar Scope, but using a conversion kit to convert Radar Scope into a completely new game. So it's a really unique challenge. They got Miyamoto, I mean, we all know who he is now, Shigeru Miyamoto, the creator of Mario, to design a game for it. And so they actually worked with the manufacturer who made the original cabinets to see what they could do with this hardware and what kind of game they could make. And I remember reading somewhere in that book where it was actually a CRT that was tilted sideways since the game was going up. Instead of programming the game to go in a certain direction, they just turned the screen sideways and it worked that way. It was a really like goofy hack to get a game to work the way they wanted without having to program it in a specific way. In any case, so since the game went vertical, Radar Scope was a vertical shooter type of thing, like kind of like Space Invaders, where your ship's at the bottom and you're shooting up to the top of the screen. You know, the sprites went up, and that's kind of where it started. So Miyamoto created Video Man, which didn't last long, and he became Jumpman. And as we all know now, Jumpman became Mario. And so he developed Donkey Kong based off of this premise. Now, there's a little bit more to it than that. You can find more detail in the book Super Mario by Jeff Ryan, but for just a brief summary of it, that's how Mario came to be. It started out as another game failing completely, needing to get saved. Miyamoto created Donkey Kong, which in turn created Jumpman, which in turn obviously became Mario.
It's pretty insane, the evolution of it. You know, who would have thought that it went from that to the arguably one of the greatest video games of all time.
I would say it's one of the most important games of all time,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely. And I believe I read somewhere that he is one of the most recognizable characters, you know, in the world.
Probably more than Mickey Mouse now.
Exactly, Mickey Mouse, yeah.
I remember there was an article that he's more recognizable than Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny now.
That's
like
crazy.
Which is nuts to think about, like the two iconic cartoon characters. They made, you know, Donkey Kong. And they wanted to kind of get a spin-off game, so they wanted to, you know, turn Jumpman into something else. And Funnily enough, the name Mario actually came from their angry landlord, mm-hmm. because they couldn't sell any radar scripts, and Nintendo had missed payments on for multiple months on the warehouse where everything was stored at, and the landlord's name was Mario. I don't remember his last name.
I think it's Sigali.
I think it's Sigali. Yeah, you're right. I think it's Sigali. So Mario Sigali, and they named him after him, and that's where the Italian heritage came from. And originally, he was supposed to be a carpenter.
Yep.
But someone told Miyamoto, it's in the book, it says who. I don't know. Do you remember?
I don't.
Someone told Miyamoto that, like, Jumpman's frame doesn't really represent a carpenter. He's kind of plump, and he's wearing overalls. He kind of looks more like a plumber from New York City. Literally, they specify New York City. And that's where the original Mario Brothers came from. Now, I probably could have, in retrospect, I probably should have included all of this in the Mario Bros. Game. But Super Mario Brothers is 10 times more important than game, in my opinion. Or it's at least more enjoyable for me. Because the original Mario Brothers game, while it's fine, it's just an arcade game. There's nothing else to it. It's a single-screen arcade game. It's meant for two players, and if you're playing by yourself, it kind of sucks.
How many levels you can get through, how many points you can score, that's pretty much all it comes down to.
Yeah. And there's not really, like, the challenge does increase as the levels go along, but it's the same challenge, if that makes sense. Super Mario Brothers, as we'll discuss a little bit more in depth as we go along, give you new challenges as the game progressed. It wasn't just the same challenge, just ramped up.
Right.
So in any case, they made Mario Brothers, hence where the pipes come from in the original Mario Brothers game, because he's a plumber, and he has to, you know, stop, basically clean out the pipes, of bugs and flies and turtles and a bunch of random shit.
Did you ever see the Atari commercial for that?
No.
It's really funny, you should check it out, it's so cheesy.
Something's coming up the plumbing, poor Luigi's in a bind. Giant turtles out to get him, creepy crabs are right behind. Fighter flies, jeepers, yikes, they're all coming out the pipes.
Mario, where are you?
It's Atari Mario Brothers, with Mario from Donkey Kong, his brother Luigi, and lots of crazy creatures. And it's twice the fun when two play at once, because you need all the help you can get.
Mario, where are you?
Mario Brothers, new from Atari.
For the original Mario Brothers, look it up on YouTube.
I'm definitely going to have to check that out then. So they made Mario Brothers, and it was a huge success, and they needed a sequel, and thus became Super Mario Brothers. And actually, sorry, before we move on to Super, interestingly enough, the inspiration for the original Mario Brothers actually was the game Joust, released, I want to say, by Midway. I don't remember now, but the arcade game Joust, where you know you're the guy flying on an ostrich and you have to, you know, ram into the other enemies on the screen. If you look at the platform placement in Joust, it's almost identical to the platform placement in the original Mario Brothers. It's not much of a coincidence, because it's clearly heavily influenced from it, and Mario came afterwards, so it makes sense that, I mean, it's like a weird ripoff, but at the same time, it's not, because the gameplay mechanics are completely different, but the idea stems from Joust, which I always thought was kind of interesting. We're on to the game, Super Mario Brothers. I mean, there's so much yet so little to say about this, because what hasn't been said? Casey, let's just start out with this. What's your favorite thing about this game, the original Super Mario Brothers?
Oh man, it's not something I've really even thought about. What is my favorite part of this game?
Favorite thing about it. Is it the music? Is it the controls? Is it the... I'm assuming it's nostalgic... the nostalgic vibe you get?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much... off the top of my head, it's definitely the nostalgic value. I mean, just because I grew up with it and I played the game so many times. But, you know, the mechanics itself... it is kind of like... A fine wine. It ages well even to this day.
I like that. Yeah. I like that comparison.
So,
well, I think my favorite thing about it is, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a later episode for Mario Month, but part of it is its impact on gaming, on like video game design in general. But let's just look at like that first level. That first level taught so much without any text. I shouldn't say there was no dialogue on old video games. It was just text. And if you think about it, so, I mean, everyone who's listening to this can probably picture the first couple screens of the original Super Mario Brothers. You know, you run to the right, you have that one Goomba coming at you on the ground, you have three blocks in a row, and then one block directly above in the middle of those three blocks. And it teaches you right off the bat that you need to jump. Even if you don't read the manual, you have to do something, because if you don't hit any buttons, even if you don't even touch the D-pad to move Mario, you will die because the Goomba is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that teaches you right there and then, you have to dodge. You have to move and jump. Or at least stand still, wait for him to come underneath you. So if you're bad at movement, you can hit the jump button and you realize, oh, when I stomp on enemies, they die. They teach you that right off the bat. Additionally, you generally, if you move immediately at the start of the game, you confront the Goomba right underneath the one of those three blocks. So right off the bat, it teaches you, oh, these blocks do something when I hit my head on them, when I jump up and touch them. And what's the first block you generally touch? The mushroom block. Mushroom pops out, it generally goes to the right, so it makes it very hard for you to avoid it. You almost have to go out of your way to not get that power-up mushroom to make Mario grow.
Right, yeah, I think I remember some people back in the day, they would avoid the mushroom because they were unsure from the beginning
what it was.
Exactly.
And then you hit, then you reach a pipe. And the next couple things are series of pipes that are growing in sizes, teaching you the height of Mario's jump, what he can do naturally without any additional help of finding other platforms to jump off of. And I can't really go on because that's all I remember off the top of my head. But think about those first couple of screens. That's amazing. That's really impressive that they teach you all of that. And additionally, it gives you incentive to explore because you hit the one block and you hear either a coin or the mushroom pop up. So then it gives you the idea, what if I hit a different one? What will happen then? And so you do that and you keep hitting them and it gives you different ideas. Additionally, since it teaches you to jump so frequently, you probably just jump around to be bored.
Right.
And that's where you find those invisible blocks. In the first level, they have a hidden block shortly after, like, the series of pipes, which one of which you can go down, which also, if you happen to do that by accident, still teaches you something. But so they even give you secrets within the first two or three frames of the game. So even if you don't know they are there, if you find out about it later on in the game just by pure accident, you're going to know what you're going to try it on other pipes to see if it works. You're going to randomly hit other blocks. The likelihood of you not hitting an invisible block somewhere in that game, if you play it from start to finish, is very unlikely.
Yeah, and I also like how it gives you like the incentive to move forward, you know, kind of trial and error, you know, what would happen if I did this? What would happen if I do that? It's kind of what you touched upon. Without the player even having to go toward the manual to even read any of this stuff, you know, it's like you said, the first few screens, you see something and you just go from there, whether or not you want to jump on it, or if you see the fire flower and you press B for the first time and you see it, the fire flower, fireball come, you know, out of Mario's hand. You know, it's pretty self-explanatory that, like, okay, this is kind of like a weapon. You know, this will kill certain enemies, and some enemies it won't. So, let's just say, like, a buzzy beetle comes toward you with a hard shell, you try shooting, it's like, okay, well, I obviously can't kill this guy, I guess I have to jump on it. So, it's pretty cool how they kind of give you a way to figure things out. You know, not too difficult, in a sense.
And even with visual cues, like you said, so you have, so the buzzy beetle, you throw the fireballs, they don't do anything, but then you stomp on it, and it, you know, curls up into a shell, then you can shoot it off.
Exactly.
But then you see other ones. I forget what the enemy's name is called, but the one, the turtles with the spike shells. Do you remember what they're called by any chance?
The spinnies, I think.
Are they just called spinnies?
I think they're called spinnies, yeah.
But in any case, they have a visual representation right on their little sprite that, hey, don't jump on this shit. It will hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find so charming about this game. Not just the fact that it is, like, it's a well-designed game, but, like, I shouldn't say charming. Charming refers more to the graphics, which we will talk about, because I do love them. But what I like so much about this is how they give you such a limited, like, palette, I guess, for lack of a better word, a limited number of moves that you can do. You have jump, you have a fireball. That's it. You don't really have any other moves. You can sprint, too, if you hold down the B button.
Right.
You have three moves. That's it. 3. Imagine that shit in like a fighting game now. Imagine that shit in any game now. But 3 moves is all you needed, and the genius designers that they were, they were able to take those 3 moves and, you know, manipulate them in different ways. In my opinion, and this doesn't just limit itself to Mario, good game design takes limited design ideas and are able to basically extrapolate them to the furthest possible possibility, for lack of a better term. They can take those basic mechanics and just stretch them as far as possible.
Right.
A perfect example of this is Portal. Portal is one of the simplest games if you think about it from a design perspective. You shoot 2 holes at a wall in 2 different walls. You walk through the one, you come out the other side. And there's a couple more mechanics. If you like jump through it, it increases your momentum and stuff like that. But they took a very simple mechanic and designed more and more complicated puzzles. And they didn't even reach the most difficult things you could have done. There's people who, like, that's why in Portal 2 they actually created a level editor for people to make their own levels. And so you can try all these crazy different ideas. And hell, you even see it with Mario Maker on the Wii U, where people take the original Mario mechanics from the original Super Mario Brothers and really like stretch it out, and like you can find really creative ways that you wouldn't have thought about.
I thought that was such a great game. It was so cool, like, just to play other people's designs.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that you have to beat your own level before you can publish it, because in that way it's kind of like, all right, I'm just going to be a dick and make the hardest level and then we'll beat it. But you have to beat it yourself in order to.
Well, there are, so
I'm sure there are ways to bypass
there's it. There's ways that people have bypassed it. They'll put invisible blocks like right on the side, right, and have the entire level like a platform directly above. So you just keep hitting the invisible blocks, go up, run over the whole level and jump down, and no one will ever know.
That's pretty funny.
And you have, like, they have to specifically know. So there are people who will who have dicked over innocent Wii U users, but you know what, they had it coming.
Yeah,
those Wii U users, including myself. But no, like, the game design is fantastic. I know we've been kind of fawning over Nintendo a lot with this, but it's a really good game. And I know this whole 40 for 40 series is nothing but NES games, but I promise you we will move on to something non-Nintendo for all you non-Nintendo fans, I promise. But indulge us for this episode. This is Mario, after all. So
I can vouch he was telling me about this, so it's going to happen.
There's new ideas coming down. So let's move on. Let's talk about the graphics. And once again, there's not much really to say about it. Like, the game design thing is something I could go on about, but graphics, they're just nice. I don't want to say there's, for the time, they are very good. I mean, obviously, Super Mario Brothers 2 and 3 had better graphics, but those were obviously later games in the NES life cycle. I don't know, just like something about the blue sky and the clouds just makes the entire game for me.
Right? Yeah, it's bright, it's vibrant, it's simple. You know, this isn't really a surprise to diehard Mario fans, but they used, you know, the same
Sprites,
yeah, the same sprites for bushes from clouds and vice versa.
Color swap that.
Yeah,
shit.
That's palette, why swap. Not, you know? And it, like I said, it's simple. You don't need all the bells and whistles to make a good game, as long as the mechanics and the stories, right? Well, not necessarily story, but as long as the mechanics are very well. You know, you have a game
well designed.
Yeah, exactly.
Very well. As long as the mechanics are very well.
Well designed, yeah. Let me finish that sentence.
No worries. But, I stutter all through this shit. People probably annoyed of it.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, like you said, when you go off the cuff.
I'm always off the cuff. I don't know how I don't stutter more, in all honesty. There's another one.
It's more fun that way. It's genuine. But, you know, it's like what we were talking about. This is like one of the more important games, arguably one of the best games ever. It's really simple even for its time, and then you have games out today like, I don't know, like No Man's Sky, which is, the graphics are really good, but
there's not a lot of content.
Yeah, exactly.
Content for
from,
it.
From my understanding, I never played it, so I can't make a comment on that, but from my understanding, the game's trash. I don't know.
Well, the problem with No Man's Sky is that the concept was really cool, and I didn't play it either, but it's like you had all these different worlds to explore, and that's awesome,
mm-hmm.
but exploration can only get you so far. So, for example, Minecraft is an awesome game. The reason why it's still so popular is because you can still build stuff. Exploration, half of that game is exploration, but the other half is building and making sure that your character can survive. That's why that game succeeds. No Man's Sky is just straight exploration. And unless you are like to explore, then you're not going to enjoy it as much. And additionally, when they promise that many worlds and that many planets to explore, you're going to get a couple palette swaps on that shit. And not to the developer's discredit, like, not to discredit the developer, that's a lot of fucking work to do. That's a lot of, like, you ever notice how in open world games, the ones that are like GTA and all the other massive open world games, you're going to see a lot of repeating shit in that because they focus their attention elsewhere. And that's why a lot of those open world games are in cities, because you can get away with that shit. Cities can blend together.
Yep.
And that's why they're in... I don't know if that's definitely why. That's my opinion, I should say, as to why. From a design standpoint, in my opinion, that's why I would put in a city. Why do you think open world games that didn't start like dealing with the wilderness didn't come out till later generations? Why do you think the first real open world game that involved like forests and shit, I shouldn't say real open world, but the first one that really was popular was Skyrim.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to a lesser degree, Fallout 3. It's because it's really fucking hard to make interesting levels. And actually, that's why Fallout is a that's why it makes more sense to be open world with Fallout, because it's post-apocalyptic. You're going to see desert everywhere. So that's a lot less to design. I'm not a big fan of Skyrim, but from a technological and development standpoint, it's amazing because they gave you so much creativity in every aspect of that world for how massive it was. It was a big world.
Yep.
And it wasn't until this current generation, I would say, that the open world game really got perfected, because you just couldn't. Even look at old Assassin's Creed games. It's the same city all over the damn place.
Right.
And you really just could not... It was hard to perfect, because... For an open world game to be outside of a city, you need to find creative things to do in it. And like you said, and that's the problem with No Man's Sky. That's why, at least I think, that it got panned after it came out, because when you want to create something like that, it's fucking hard. That's why those games, especially like the open world games, you ever see the credit list on those shit, on those things?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
I don't even know how we got off on topic for that.
But that's what's cool about, you know, these indie developers, you know, they will make these types of games, you know, very similar.
To Mario.
Yeah, to Mario, influenced, and not even that, but like the older Nintendo games that have been very influential. And, you know, when you keep it simple like that and add your own touch to it, it always comes out well. I mean, there are, of course, exceptions. Oh my god, that game's so good.
It's a great
game. Yeah. But, I mean, of course there's always exceptions to the rule, but for the most part... You know, you're always going to play something very well.
But, to go back to the art graphics.
Every time.
Man, like, tangents galore. It's great, though. But no, like you were talking about the palette swaps, how they just took the bushes and turned them into the clouds and shit.
Right.
You don't even notice that at first. When you're a kid playing that, it just, that's good art direction, in my opinion. When you take... The same sprite and just swap palettes, and you barely notice until you really have to play it a couple times or you're an adult. That's good art direction.
It is.
And it's stuff that still holds up, because even though you know it's a palette swap now, it still fucking looks good.
And it works, too. Exactly. Like, why even have to change it?
So I will say, to kind of move on a little bit, the only criticism I have of this game is actually its physics. And while Mario still controls well... The only problem I have with it is that he's a little bit floaty. Like, he slides a little bit, even when it's not, like, there's no ice in this level. Or in Mario 1, I don't believe, anyway. Not that I saw with all the levels that we were looking at. We did actually play this, by the way. We almost beat it. I literally touched the axe that was going to kill Bowser right when he jumped on me, and the game registered that as him killing me instead of me killing him. So, kind of sucked. I was this close.
Yeah, I would play it, and beat it as a kid on the All-Stars version. But and it's kind of like what you're going back to. I think at the time the controls were very, very good.
I would agree with that. I think it's more in retrospect.
Exactly. You know, because there have been so many remakes of but you know, you have the All-Stars version.
Well, refinements, because this was the first game of that style. Like, Super Mario Brothers really laid the grounds for what platformers were going to be. It was nowhere near the first platformer game. Like, even Adventure on the Atari 2600, Pitfall on the Atari 2600 was an early platformer game.
Right. E.T.? No.
I mean, kind of, I guess. no, but you're right. I would say for the time, the controls were great. I just, I like if you jump from Super Mario Brothers 3 on the NES to Super Mario 1, yeah, graphics it's totally different. Like that. Yeah. But the physics
are way more redefined.
Yeah, they're way more reactive. Like, yeah. You have more control over Mario and his jump arc,
yeah.
Which is always such a weird thing. If you really think about it, what kind of game lets you literally, like, when you jump, you can, like, if you jump in one direction, you can literally guide them back in that same arc if you hit the buttons at the right time.
Yeah, that is pretty...
Like, if you think about it, that in a real world, I wouldn't say innovative, it's just weird physics.
Well, I mean, it's just not something we haven't seen before.
Because think about it, actually, if you want to think of realistic, original Castlevania on the NES, mm-hmm. When you jump, you're committing to the jump. You cannot change directions mid-jump. In the original Castlevania, you hit that jump button, he's going on that same arc, so if you timed your jump wrong, you're going down the hole.
Yeah.
In Mario, if you timed your jump wrong, you still, depending on how bad you fuck up, you still generally have a chance to kind of guide Mario back to the platform.
Right, and we kept doing that when we were trying to warp to 8-1, and that...
that was awful.
Yeah, every time we just kept trying to hit that invisible block and to hit the vine, but... yeah, I mean, it is goofy, but at the, like, when I say innovative, I mean, I believe at that time, there really hasn't been something like that. You know, going back to the whole Castlevania thing, in the realistic sense, you know, you are committed to that jump. If you go there, like, there's no going back.
You're fucked.
Yeah, exactly.
If you time it wrong, you're fucked.
If you get hit, you're gonna get,
Knocked back,
yes. You know, with Mario, they don't have that. It's either you die or you lose... You know, you lose your mushroom, go back to, you know, small Mario, and then use the invisibility frames to run like hell. Invincibility frames to run like hell, so.
Invisibility.
Invince.
As a reminder, I don't know, I would always say invisibility frames when I was a kid, mm-hmm. And I would also say instead of AI bots, I always called them OW bots. Like, for whenever you had, like, multiplayer games on the N64, you had the AI. I thought that was an L, so I'm like, why are they called OW bots? What the fuck? Who's OW? What did Al do?
Damn it, Al.
Al. All right, so the controls overall are... I keep using this expression, and every games journals use this expression. The controls are tight. They're good. They're solid controls. Physics are a little wonky, but like you said, Casey, for the time, they were fantastic. And they were the first of its kind. Additionally, Mario is one of the first games to, on a home console, to allow... continuous scrolling. A lot of times you would go from screen to screen. There was no scrolling of the screen. Mario was one of the first games, the NES was one of the first home consoles, not even just in terms of home consoles, but in general, like arcades and stuff, to really figure that out. And it brought it to the masses. And that, I would argue, the most important aspect of Super Mario Brothers, I mean, there's so many, but I would say... And from a technological standpoint, at least, the most important aspect was the horizontal scrolling.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not a gameplay design thing, even though it does play into it. But in terms of a technological aspect, what that game was able to do with the horizontal scrolling, that was, no one had seen that before. So that was huge. That was really huge. So, yeah, that's about all I have to say about the gameplay and mechanics, and we kind of talked about design along all in there. Do you have anything left to say about that before we move on?
No, I feel like we've touched upon pretty much everything we wanted to.
All right. So, the last thing that I really want to touch on before we wrap up this episode for the original Super Mario Brothers, the music. And I'm not going to sing the song. We all know it. You're hearing it in your head right now. I know all you guys, your girls or people, you're hearing it in your head right now. That music's amazing. No ifs, ands, or buts. I don't care if you hate Nintendo. You can't deny that it's a catchy song. Even if you don't like the song, it's still catchy. It's like that's, even if you hate Mario and you hate that song, it's a song you love to hate.
I feel like everybody and their mother knows it.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be very surprised as to
who's
never heard of it before.
Literally, the first thing that anybody, like, you watch any I Love the 80s shit on, like, VH1 or whatever, or any, like, commentary about Mario by people who are normally outside of, like, this whole, like, gaming scene, like, the hardcore gaming scene, I guess you say, the people who go to gaming conventions. Anyone outside of that, you say Super Mario, the first thing they're doing is do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Mm-hmm.
First thing, no matter what. That's the power of soundtrack or album, this game's soundtrack, this OST.
Yep.
Koji Kondo composed it and did a fantastic job as per usual. But I guess it wasn't as per usual then. That was, like, relatively new for him. But I'm still fascinated by it, dude. Like, you think about the NES and how it only has 3 sound channels. And, like, that's a pretty strict limitation. Actually, sorry, 4 sound channels. It had a sound channel for generally sound effects, and the other 3 were for music. And, you know, like, other game consoles of the time, like the Sega Master System, technically were more powerful. I don't know about in terms of sound, but at least in graphics, the Master System was more powerful than the NES, but just didn't have the games, excuse me, didn't have the games really to back it up. So I don't know if the Master System had that, but the NES, I'm still amazed that it only had really 4 sound channels, and the music that they were able to produce out of those 4 sound channels.
Yeah.
But, do you have anything about the music you wanted to say? I mean, I feel like everyone said
exactly,
everything
pretty much. There really isn't anything, you know, substantial or new to discuss about it. I mean, it's just, it's great. It's catchy. It's innovative. I mean, even to this day, it's very, very, very popular. It's like you said.
It's really kind of set the template for what all Mario music was going to be. Because you even, like, you, when you hear a Mario song, you know what it is. Like, it's very distinct in what type of sound the song is written in. And I really feel like the first Mario song really laid the groundwork for that. First Mario game really laid the ground for that.
I agree.
But yeah, so, do you have any final thoughts on the original Super Mario Brothers, Casey, before we wrap this whole thing up with some shout-outs?
It just has been so influential in my life, you know, specifically my gaming life, my personal life in terms of nostalgia and bonding with my grandfather, even though that was for a later Mario game, but just Mario as a character himself, it's indescribable. It's like winning the Stanley Cup. You can't say anything. There are no words.
And speaking of Stanley Cup, congratulations to the Washington Capitals. Not the team I was hoping to get for. I mean, without going into too much, you and I are Flyers fans. Mm-hmm. Don't want to rile up all the angry NHL fans, but, you know, we're not dicks about it.
Nah, I gotta give credit where credit's due.
Ovi got it. Finally got his cup.
Unless it's the Pens.
Yeah. But no, so now it's time for some shout-outs, and I would like to give some shout-outs to The Apex and the Abyss. Erica is the host of that show. It's a fantastic podcast show. It is a true crime podcast. Go give it a listen if you like kind of creepy, dark stories and true stories, mind you. And she's a fantastic podcast host, and it's a really good podcast. Also, some shout outs to Two Guys in a Game and The Hotter Show. TJ is the co-host on Two Guys in a Game and the main host on The Hotter Show. Please give both of those podcasts a listen. They are big supporters of mine, as I am of theirs. Fantastic podcast. Also, go check out No Geeks Allowed. That's spelled KNOW. No Geeks Allowed. That's an awesome podcast with a friend I used to work with and one of his buddies, and a couple of his buddies, actually. They have an awesome podcast. They were really nice and gave me a nice shout out in their last episode. They were talking about E3 a whole bunch and what their picks for what the N64 Mini should contain. So definitely go check out their most recent episode. Also check out Drinks with Larry, a bunch of awesome comedians being funny as hell. Check out Christian and Damon's Amazing Nerd Show. You can find them on Twitter at Amazing Nerd Show. Now that I think about it, I probably should have given out Twitter for the other guys. Two Guys in a Game, I think, is T2AA Game on Twitter. Drinks with Larry is just Drinks with Larry. Apex and Abyss is at Apex and Abyss. I mean, I'll put all their stuff in the show notes just because I know I'm going to forget. I'm going to misspell some of these because I'm doing this all off the top of my head. But no, and I guess that pretty much wraps it all up. So you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at StillLoadingPod on all of them. Please don't hesitate to reach out and email me. You can email me at stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. And I believe that's it. Casey, do you have anything to plug? Do you have any of your... Oh, do you want to plug your Instagram at all?
Yeah, sure. My Instagram is Kazuya Kane. That's KAZUYAKAN as in November, E. I basically just post all video game-related content for the most part, mainly my collection and other sorts of memorabilia. You'll see a lot of Super Mario, Tekken, retro game stuff, and just gaming in general, so...
All right. And that about wraps it up, guys. So thank you all once again for listening. And actually, you will hear from both of us next time.